Together with American Songwriter, we had the opportunity to talk to Rachel Baiman over Zoom video. Rachel Baiman was born and raised outside of Chicago. She talks about how she got into music. She picked up the fiddle at a very early age, and she told us about how her fiddle teacher became a very big mentor of hers. She told us about competing in fiddle competitions as a young girl, actually winning the Illinois State Fiddle Championship at 17. She talked about moving to Nashville to go to college, and that's when she really started to pursue music full time. Rachel told us about forming 10 String Symphony, her first project, the success of that project, putting out her first record as a solo artist, touring as a solo artist for the first time, where she was when the pandemic hit, and all about her brand new record, Cycles. You can watch our interview with Rachel on our Facebook page and YouTube channel at Bringing It Backwards. It'd be rad if you subscribe to our channel, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Bringing Back Pod.
We'd appreciate your support if you follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're Bringing It Backwards with Rachel Baiman. This podcast is all about you and your journey in music and how you got to where you are now.
Sounds good. No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. Exactly. And we'll also talk about the new record coming out next month as well. But
sounds good.
Cool. First off, why don't you talk to me about where you were born and raised?
So I'm from Chicago. I was raised on the west side of Chicago in Oak Park. And my parents were originally from the East Coast and they met contra dancing. So when I kind of randomly stumbled upon fiddle music, they knew what that was. You know, they were kind of familiar with it and were like, oh, that's cool. Whereas most people in Chicago were not aware of that. And definitely at my public schools, it was kind of like my double life. I didn't really talk about my fiddle life.
Oh, interesting. The worlds didn't collide, the fiddle world and your regular school life?
They did not collide. I did not talk about it very much until, of course, there was the classic, you know, someone wanted to do a Dave Matthews Band cover in high school. And suddenly I was really cool for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, they're like, Rachel could play fiddle.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay, well, when did you get into fiddle? Like, how old were you when you started learning how to play it?
I was really young. I wanted to play an instrument when I was I had an older brother and he had started playing the trumpet. And I was like, oh, I want to play something. But of course, being four, the options are a little limited in terms of your instruments. And
recorder.
Oh, you can do piano or violin. And around the corner from our house, there was this kind of, you know, budget violin lesson kind of situation. They're like, that'll be good. But it just happened to be a fiddle player from Missouri who had moved to Chicago. And so rather than taking violin lessons, I was actually kind of taking fiddle lessons without realizing. And then I just got super into it. He was a great mentor for me. His name was Mike Casey for, you know, until I was 18, basically. I learned fiddle with him for basically as long as he felt like he had something to teach me. And then he wanted to show me some guitar and banjo. So I did all kinds of kind of basic fundamental music skills with him, and specifically in like kind of folk and traditional American music realm.
Very cool. And so that's, well, I did read that you won like your state champion fiddle player at 17.
Yeah, that was kind of that was something that he introduced me to as well. He was like, oh, you should come to some fiddle contests. And those were all in kind of rural areas of Illinois. Uh-huh. Which is a whole different world than Chicago. And that was kind of cool because I could meet some other kids my age that were learning fiddle. And I had my kind of fiddle buddies that I would see at the contests. And, you know, we would compete, but it was pretty low key. It was wasn't that serious. It was usually at like the county fair or whatever, you know. So it was a chance to kind of catch up with my few peers that I had in Illinois and figure out what tunes people were playing, and it was something to work towards. So that was really fun. And my parents and Jill did those. Sorry.
They would your parents would take you to the competitions.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, I was gonna ask, what does a fiddle competition look like? Like, do you play a tune and the other person has to like mimic? Like, how do you battle on the fiddle field?
Yeah, usually you have three tunes. So you have a a hoedown, a waltz, and a tune of choice. So that's okay. Kind of like a fast danceable tune, a waltz, and then something. Often the tune of choice is kind of like in the swing realm or something mm-hmm. more kind of, it's a chance to show off some sort of tricks that you might have. And I mean, fiddle contest playing has little to do with, you know, it's not a great judge of like true musicality, but it's a great thing if you're just a kid needing something to practice for.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's really cool though. I've never heard of a fiddle competition like that.
Well, before, you are missing out on a lot of fried food and fair culture.
I know. I just moved to Nashville. I don't know if you can tell all the stuff that's in my room right here, but my family and I just moved here and I saw that you were living in Nashville.
Yeah.
I'm curious, is there a fiddle contest close by here? Cause I'd love to.
There are. Yeah. There's some more old time oriented ones around here. The Bell's Bend Farm usually puts one on that I've gone to, and that's a true, like an old time fiddle contest, which is sort of different than there's all these different like subgenres of fiddle playing. There's like Texas style, which is like a super intense contest scene. And then the old time contests, which are much more about kind of authenticity of vibe, which is a hard thing to judge, but can be really cool to listen to. Yeah. And then there's a Smithville, there's a fiddlers convention. I don't know if they have a contest, but you can definitely find some contests in Tennessee if you want. I haven't been like seeking them out very much lately, except for a few weeks ago when I saw that Bell's Bend one and I was like, oh, I need some money. I'm going to that.
That's awesome. Well, okay. So fiddle player throughout high school and middle school and everything.
Yeah, really. I always played, but I got super into it in high school. That's when I had the opportunity to travel actually to the outside of Nashville to a kind of a workshop put on by Mark O'Connor, which had the most incredible fiddle players across all the genres. And that's when I first heard, you know, Round Peak old time style music and some of the Canadian styles of fiddle music. So it really opened up my world from the kind of Midwestern fiddle tune vibe to all of these other things you could do with music. You know, I heard singing with the fiddle, which became like a big part of some, what I wanted to do, and just real masters of the tradition that I hadn't been exposed to at all prior to that.
When did you start trying to sing? Were you singing and writing your own songs and fiddle, or were you trying to learn covers? Like how did that work when you
I started with old time tunes, you know, trying to imitate some of the players I heard. And I remember my sister would, she always makes fun of me because like I would be up late at night downstairs in the living room trying to learn how to do this. And I would be singing the same phrase over and over and over and over because I was trying to get my motor skills to line up. And uh-huh. She was like, oh, I was trying to fall asleep. And he just kept singing over and over and over that same line. I was going to kill you. So there was definitely a long process. And it definitely, yeah, it started just with old time tunes. And my own songwriting came a little bit later.
When did you start writing your own music?
I started late in college. So maybe when I was 20 or 21, I guess I wrote maybe one or two songs before that with my like weird high school, like rock, you know, I had all these weird, like diversions of attempting sure. to find people to play with, which were largely unsuccessful until I got to Nashville. And I think I had started, I got super deep into the fiddle. Even, you know, Nashville, that's what I thought that I was going to pursue. Like, I'm going to be an instrumentalist. Uh-huh. I had my, I'd just gotten my 5-string fiddle, which is just like a wider range of the instrument and has that low C string. So I was spending a lot of time trying to figure that out. And it opens up a lot of possibilities for singing because you have that lower range. Mm-hmm. So I started this fiddle duo with Christian Settlemeyer, which became 10 String Symphony, which was the band that I toured with for like many years before starting my solo project. And that band, you know, we started doing mostly covers and it was kind of about arranging for the fiddles, but it was also the platform I needed to kind of kick my butt into writing some original material. Mm-hmm. And over my few years living in Nashville, I had really, really fallen in love with songwriting. I think it's an easy thing to do living here. You're constantly surrounded by songwriters, and hearing, you know, the kind of mystique of the great song is everywhere in Nashville. And I totally fell in love with that and wanted to kind of give it a try. So that project is kind of where I started writing my own songs. And I was largely the lyrical writer for that band the whole time. Mm-hmm. Christian would sometimes work with me on melodies and stuff, and he was a huge part of the arranging process, but that was mainly me writing the songs.
Wow. And what took you to Nashville? Was it music and playing fiddle?
Yeah, I was in school at Vanderbilt, and that was kind of just a way for me to get to Nashville. I don't think I ever felt comfortable declaring that I wanted to pursue music. Mm-hmm. I just kind of went to school. I had a scholarship to go to Vanderbilt, and that was a really good opportunity financially.
That's huge. What did you go to the scholarship for? Was it for music?
So it was, I couldn't study music because Vanderbilt has a classical conservatory, which I did not audition for. I was not like a great classical violinist. I just, I was sort of, you know, I played in orchestra and stuff, and I can get by, I can play wedding gigs and stuff, but I'm not going to be hired by the Nashville Symphony. Okay. So anyway, I wasn't, I didn't audition for that. I had pretty good academics, and for the kind of scale that Vanderbilt is seeking, I was kind of a poor kid, you know, by their standards, even though I had a very nice middle-class upbringing, but mm-hmm. It's a super wealthy school, and they attract mm-hmm. a lot of kind of wealthy elite. And so they gave me a scholarship, but I had to be in the School of Arts and Sciences. That was kind of where they were. That was the parameter of the scholarship. So I studied anthropology, and I did that mainly just because it was super interesting. And I wrote a lot of papers about fiddle music. It was just sort of like, you know, anthropology is so wide reaching. You can kind of decide your topic based on what you're interested in. And I loved my classes. I mean, I had really amazing professors. And when I graduated, I had already started playing some gigs with 10th Street Symphony, and we'd recorded our first little EP, and I just kind of didn't get a job. Like, I just didn't apply for anything. And so even though I never said to myself, I'm going to pursue music, I kind of just did it and was like, oops, I guess I'm doing this full-time music thing now. And of course I had to hustle up random jobs along the way all the time. Sure. I just never got that 9-to-5 security, which I could have sought, I guess. I mean, an anthropology degree is not the most, I would say, like, valuable in the workforce, but you know, I probably could have gotten something, but I was just like, never did that. And I think that was actually really helpful because I never had to quit that security, you know?
Yeah. You didn't have like a backup plan. It was just
when you don't have that, then you never have to be like, okay, I'm making this really scary choice. You're just kind of in the thick of it.
Sure. When did you start seeing success with 10 String Symphony?
We were just such a, you know, scrappy indie band, and we needed so little in terms of money, logistics. Like, it was just the two of us. We could travel in a tiny car. And so we kind of were making money from the beginning in this like very DIY gig to gig kind of way. And I was lucky because Christian had a lot more experience than me. He had been in a touring band before, and he knew kind of like some of the things that go along with it. He had some connections. And so for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, we just plugged away at it, did our own thing, kind of booked our own little tours. And when there's just two of you and your expenses are so low, you know, we would always stay at people's houses on the floor. Like, there was nothing cushy about this gig. It was like,
no, you know, overhead.
No overhead. It was like, yes, that was it. You know, like driving like 15 hours between gigs, sleeping in weird people's closets. Like, it was just whatever we had to do. And And so, yeah, so that was enough. I mean, I needed so little to live on at that point. I was sharing a house and, you know, my rent was super low. And so I was just kind of getting by on that. And then when we didn't have gigs, I would pick up a job. I had one job working for a Vanderbilt professor when my job was to read books and write reports on them. That was an awesome job. Then I got kicked off that job because it was supposed to be for students. And I had it like 3 years longer than I was supposed to.
Whoops.
Yeah. And then I did random things. Like I would work catering or I would, I don't know. I did all kinds of weird things. I like was a personal house cleaner for this lady, you know, just like whatever. It was like, okay, I need money this month. What am I going to do? Kind of.
Sure.
But after a few years, we did get a booking agent, and that was like kind of the first big step. And then, yeah, it got a little bit better from there. So then we got a little more pro every year, you know?
Sure. And when did you decide to put out your first self-titled record, and what made you go solo, or was there a reason?
Yeah. So it got released in 2017. So I probably started recording it 2016 or late 2015, maybe. Uh-huh. And I was just writing. I had continued to write a lot of songs, and I felt like I was kind of gathering this collection of songs that was a little bit outside of the realm of the material for 10 String Symphony. I think we had, you know, the beautiful thing about that duo was like the limitations, like they bred this like intense creativity, because we had to do crazy things to make a band work with just two fiddles. It was like, you know, we were doing all kind of rhythmic experimentation and harmonic madness, and it was really fun. But I wrote some songs that were just so kind of, they felt so straightforward, that, and also really personal. Like a lot of that material on that first album was like pretty personal and very like very much about my experience as a woman, and it just didn't feel like the right, you know, fit for that project. And we continued to do that project, but I was like, I'm just going to record this other thing. And Christian was always doing a lot of other projects as well. And so, you know, it was like totally, that was pretty normal. And I reached out to Andrew Marlin of Mandolin Orange, because I had been, or now Watch House, I guess is their new band name, but I had been really in love with the records they were putting out, and I knew that he was recording them in his own studio, local studio, and he was into it. He agreed that we should do some recording together, so that's kind of how that project was born. And I never really had the intention of like, oh, I'm gonna go solo now, you know. I was just kind of following what felt right musically, and that turned out to be an album that I was really excited about, really passionate about. And I pitched it to this small label in DC, and they took it, which was incredible, because I literally was just like at this music conference, and I like knew the guy was right there, and I was like, okay, gonna go up to him, can talk to him, gonna tell him you have an album. Like I gave myself a pep talk like 8 times, and I like walk over there, and then I would like swerve back because I was terrified. You know, like you'd be getting those like shakes, like oh god.
Yeah.
So finally I just went over and was really awkward and was like, I have a new album.
Here it is.
It was just like the most awkward whole time.
Well, it worked.
But it worked incredibly. You know, I'm so thankful for that. And also it's like one of those things where you're like, you just got to do it. You got to do it.
And once they put out that record, were you able to tour as a solo artist? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, that was a huge stepping stone for me, that record, because I got a lot of really good publicity. I think it was, I'm super proud of the record, but I also think it was a lucky moment in time, in the sense that I was writing about, the record's called Shame, and it was all about kind of the female experience in America. And when it came out, like Trump had just been elected, and there was just like a huge reckoning about the realities of sexism and misogyny that was still so incredibly present and in the music industry as well. And so I think the subject matter was hitting people in a way that was really helpful at the time, like in that moment. And it was definitely the most ambitious and I think like maybe not the most ambitious. I mean, in some ways it was more normal in terms of what people hear as music than Tenshin Symphony, but it just was like extremely personal, I guess, mm-hmm. and very much like me as opposed to a band. And so I think there's a lot of power in that as well, and like that vulnerability. So yeah, it was a big moment for me. There was a lot of coverage with like NPR, and I got a lot of attention from Spotify. And so it enabled me to kind of start really touring under my own name and taking things again, just like one little notch up, which is kind of always the way it's been for me. I don't think I'm ever going to be an artist that's just like, boom, it's just a slow climb, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
But I feel like that's probably a better, I don't know. I would think that might be a better route to be on because
I don't know.
You could have the one TikTok smash, right? And then what?
Yeah, that's
your
true.
Eyes are on you, and then they can dart away.
Yeah. Whereas
the way you're playing it, it's, I mean, you have a lot of success on that first record, even the more recent songs you've put out. I mean, millions of streams. So obviously, yeah, I mean, people are paying attention and they've been hanging on for a while.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Like, I always think about, like, well, if you're going to have success in one realm, I mean, there's so many avenues to take now in terms of like how to be like you said, you can be literally a musician who's famous on TikTok. Uh-huh. And nobody's ever heard of you who's not on TikTok. Like, it's crazy. There's all these different ways. You can be a YouTube musician. You can be a live musician. You know, there's like all these different ways you can get your music out. And I'm glad that it's like the most success I've had is on Spotify. And that's a platform where people literally listen to your music. So I'm like, okay.
Right. It's for music fans. That's where they go for it. Right.
The success on Spotify means not that people are liking photos of me, but that they're listening to my music, which is great. I mean, if people want to like photos of me, great. Like, I'm just glad it's like in that musical realm. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's any right or wrong way. I just think that I'm just going to be that person making the slow journey. Like, I'm not like a big horoscope person, but I am like a Capricorn, which is like just the goat. And I was just picture walking slowly up the hill, just like plodding forever.
Well, I mean, like I said, the success of the record is amazing. And the fact that you have people that have followed you for this long and that are actual like fans, not like one of those 15 seconds of like this one big fad hit.
Yeah.
And then it's like no one's paying attention anymore, because I mean, you're able to make a career out of this. I don't know how many of these TikTok artists are going to be able to say that.
Yeah. Well, I hope that that's true. And I definitely feel really grateful for being able to continue to tour and make music.
Yeah.
In general.
With that in the touring aspect and how this whole past couple year or year plus have been, where were you when COVID hit and how did that affect this new record that you have coming out?
Well, it was terrifying at first. I think I had already recorded the new record and I was really excited to get it out there. And obviously that took a really long time for obvious reasons. And in hindsight, now that it's actually coming out in a way that I'm really happy with, I can go, oh, this all worked out great. But at the time it was just like, oh my God, I had so many tours canceled. I mean, I was on tour when, like, I was starting out on a tour with Delamay. We were supposed to play 5 or 6 shows and then come home, and we played one show and then the whole tour was canceled. We just drove straight back home.
Oh, wow.
I had this whole tour booked in May in Europe, in the UK with a whole band. Like, I had booked everyone's plane tickets. They were sitting on my credit card. There's so much, you know what I mean? There's so much overhead with this stuff. Uh-huh. So I had my whole band's flights, credit cards, hotels on my credit card. And when that got canceled, I was just like, man, you know, I don't know how I'm going to weather this storm. Like, financially, it was just a terrible place to be in. And I had already put in so much money to record the new album and was sitting on that. And of course, there ended up being a lot of help from the government, which I just did not expect. Like, that was never on my radar. Being able to collect unemployment as a musician just feels I could not actually believe that that was a thing. And a lot of the, you know, the airlines refunded my tickets, which never happened before in COVID.
Right, sure.
So, you know, it ended up being okay, but there was like that month of just absolute panic on top of just the kind of domino effect of gigs getting canceled and canceled and canceled and canceled. And when it's so funny to think back on it, because we're like, oh man, I hope the summer festivals don't get canceled. And right now we're like in the next summer and festival.
Yeah, I hope this next summer festival doesn't get canceled.
Exactly. So we just had such a short term view of it, which I think we just had to do for our mental health. But
yeah.
Because if you just, you have to ease into the idea that you're going to be home for a year. You can't just be told that in one day. Like, it's too scary.
Right. So, I know. It's in the very beginning, I remember talking to my, my just internal medicine doctor when I was in San Diego at the time. And I asked him, I was like, you know, like, how long would you guess this is going to go for? And he looked at me, or he basically told me, there's no way that 2 weeks is going to be enough time. He said, everybody in the whole world will have to stay inside for like months before, if you think that there's any end in sight, basically. And I was like, oh, wow. So like, he kind of really hit me with it right up front. I'm like, nah, I don't know about this guy, but like, here we are, you know, over a year later.
2 months later. Oh yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, yeah. It was just wild to even like thinking back on those, or like when it first started, like, yeah, that was a very scary time. I mean, it was a weird time.
Yeah, it was terrible. And once the kind of financial stuff came through and I felt like, okay, I'm not going to starve. Mm-hmm. Great. I'm not going to like lose my house. And because my husband's also a touring musician. So it was like, we were just in the same boat. We have a mortgage and we had debts to pay. And it was just like, oh my God. But, once we kind of came out of that, so I guess it took about a month for them to figure out, okay, we're going to hand out some unemployment to musicians. I was really just obsessing over this record, and I just, it's so like something I've been thinking about a lot is like, I had just turned 30 and I feel this like intense pressure because I'm a woman and I have this like biological clock, and I'm like, okay, like, I have to spend, you know, I have to just like go so hard. If I like want, I have this fear that I'm going to like miss my chance to have a kid. I don't even know if I want to have a kid, but I have the fear of regretting it if I don't. And so I'm like, okay, I have to just go super hard for like 2 years. And then I'll like, hopefully be in a position where like I could take some time off or like tour a little bit less for a little while. And of course, what ended up happening is I sat in my house for 2 years and didn't do, you know, it's like you miss that window of progress. And so I think that I did have a lot of like panic about that. But now that it's like, okay, now things are really picking up. I've got this new album come out. It doesn't feel like that big of a deal now that I missed this window, because I mean, everyone did. It was like a total pause. It's not like I was falling behind, which is not a real thing anyway, but it feels that way at times. But anyway, so it did give me the chance to really gather an awesome team. So I was able to sign with a new label. Well, first I got a new manager. He was able to help me sign with a new label. And I have an awesome new booking agent. And like, it just really gave me the headspace to put together a really good way to put out the album. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I had just finished the album and I was sending it around to all these labels, people that had support, like even the label that I put out Shame On, and like people that had supported me in the past, everyone was just in such a bad place that it was just like, can't, no way, no, can't do, no can do. And I was like, I thought I was going to have like, you know, three options to put it out, and they all said no. And I was like, oh my God, like everything. So, yeah. Anyways, so that was the pandemic, and
but it all worked out, obviously. I mean, yeah, the record's coming out. You found a home for it. You have tour dates on the books, which is probably really exciting.
it's so exciting. It feels honestly surreal, and everything after a year of doing nothing, everything is so exciting that I almost can't handle it emotionally, because I'm used to being like at zero, you know, like you right. you steal yourself for a life of just like routine. And then when it comes back to like this adrenaline and dopamine hits every day, I'm like, oh my God, like I can't handle this level of excitement in my life.
Sure.
But it's wow. great. It is great.
I think, I've said this a few times lately, now that stuff's opening up, but like, I feel people are going to appreciate the live music atmosphere a lot more now, instead of, you know, being like, oh, you know, Rachel, come back next month, or, you know, I'll catch you the next time around, or it's Thursday night. People are going to be itching to get out no matter what day of the week it is, no matter how many times they can see that artist again.
I really hope so. I mean, I've had a couple times where I've been able to hear someone play live, and it's made me so emotional, because you forget how magical that experience is. And it's just not the same watching it through the screen. Like, it's just not the same experience. And I think people know that now, because they're tired of watching things through a screen. And hopefully we all just like value that specialness of those atmospheres a little bit more, as you said.
Yeah. I mean, I even remember when we were moving, we just moved, like I said, we just moved to Nashville a couple months ago, but when my wife and I were coming out here to look at places, getting off the airplane and there was an artist, just like a guy playing in one of the restaurants inside the airport. I was like, whoa, like it was just such a different experience. I'm like, there's a person actually playing like live music right now. Like,
I know,
it's just some random guy, but like, let's soak this in for a second. Like, it's so crazy.
It is really amazing to realize what we've been missing, you know?
Yeah. It was just one of those, like, wow, I forgot how amazing this feels and this is. And it was just a guy who just happened to be playing in this.
Tootsie's in the DNA.
Yeah, I don't know where it was. It was just a little place in the airport.
Yeah. It was Tootsie's.
Okay. But yeah, it's awesome. Stuff's starting to come back, and congratulations on a new record. You said it, can you tell me about like how it was, you said the record was done. Was there anything you added to it, or production wise, did that change the course of the album through the whole pandemic, or was it done and you just kind of left it as is?
So I recorded it at the very end of 2019.
Okay.
We were in Melbourne, Australia. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. I made it with, an artist that I love very much named Olivia Halley, who's the frontwoman of a band called OPEP, which is like a really cool kind of indie pop band out of Melbourne, but they're super like roots based. So it's kind of, they both have a background in folk music, and there's a fiddle and mandolin player in the band. And so they just had this, they have this incredible sound and this incredible take on folk and Americana that definitely, you know, verges into pop and indie, which is not really the direction I went, but I just wanted that, the influence of that sound. And, and also Olivia's kind of songwriting sensibility is really incredible. And so she helped me kind of shape a lot of the songs around their end. Once I had kind of got the general gist of it, she would kind of come in and just make it that 10% like better. That would just blast it off, which is really cool. So we had recorded the album. I was just riding so high, you know, it was an amazing experience getting to be in Melbourne, such a cool city. I was I had booked a couple festivals over there, and then we had like 7 days between to record. So it was like this super intense, you know, we had a time limit. So it was just like, you know, tunnel laser vision, getting this thing done. And I was thrilled with it. And then I spent many months working with a mix engineer, Shawnee Gandhi, here in Nashville, who's like incredible Grammy winning engineer. She's done a lot of work with like Sarah Jarosz, Parker Millsap. And she agreed to mix the record. And that was like a long process going back and forth with her. And then I was like, all right, this is awesome. Got to sign it off. I mean, what happened really was that when you ask about how the pandemic changed it, I mean, the problem was I had as much time as I wanted to throw mixes back and be like, okay, no, we got to change this. And I specifically remember being, my husband and I were at my parents' house in Chicago for some reason. And I was like listening to these mixes and headphones over and over and over and being like, oh no, it's all wrong. I got to do this, this, and this, and this. And he was like, I was like, do you hear how the bass is like booming here? And I gave him the headphones and he was like, no, it just sounds like a bass. I was like, it's boomy. And I had like tried to fix this so many times. And he was like, Rachel, you need to be done. Put this down. Like, put it down. It was like, you know, the seventh round of mixed notes kind of vibe.
Sure.
It's like when you don't have a deadline, because no one had said, yes, we'll put this out. It needs to be done by X date. So I was like, well, the pandemic hit and I have as long as I want to get these mixes absolutely perfect. And like, mixes are never perfect. Like, it's just, it's an endless, you can work on it for a century, you know, and you'd still be like, well, maybe. Anyway, he was like, no, you need to put this down like right now. Shawnee's going to like quit this project if you don't stop. And I'll like, sounds great. And just like, leave it alone. So I was like, okay. You're right. So that was kind of the main spit in terms of the musical aspect of it that the pandemic affected. And then I got it mastered. And once it's mastered, you kind of like, you can't. Done. Really. That's kind of a good, I wonder if that process just exists for that reason. It's like, I'm just going to do this so that everyone has just a cutoff. You can't change anything.
Right.
So,
yeah. No more changes. It's considered finished now.
Yeah, exactly. And then most of like what I did during the pandemic was like a lot of preparation. I mean, I had so much time to make videos and like different types of content to go along, so that by the time we got to the pitching to the record label, it was like, here's a finished album. Here's three finished music videos. Here's the promotional photos. You know, like we had everything. It was like,
yeah, you had the whole package for
so long. Yeah. It was like, we had such a long lead time. So that's been really cool for, in terms of the rollout. I mean, once you start working with your publicist, there's just so much going on and it's hard to fit in doing those things in a way that doesn't feel rushed, you know? And so I was able to do them in a way that felt very pure and creative. And that was really cool. And just constantly thinking about what I wanted to do, obsessing over it, maybe a little too much time for that.
Sure. Yeah. Have you ever collaborated with your husband as far as like writing on the records or anything like that?
We haven't written much. I mean, I think he's very much an instrumentalist. So he also plays fiddle and banjo, and he doesn't live much in the world of songs. Like, he's very much in the world of instrumental music in terms of his own creations, but he writes a lot of instrumental music, like really beautiful tunes. And we did, there's one song on I have an EP called Thanksgiving, and he helped me with the kind of melodic aspect of one of the songs on there, because we were on this writing retreat together called the Stetson Kennedy Songwriting Residency, which was really cool. But so we do play together sometimes. I tried really hard for us not to play together.
Why is that?
I don't like having all of those things in one space. Like, it, mm-hmm. I think anyone that has been in a band knows that the relationship you have with your bandmates is like one of like pure love and pure hate at the same time. Like, you just, sure. it's like a whole nother marriage or family. Okay. And then if you have an actual marriage on top of that, I think you lose those like boundaries of politeness, yeah. And
blurs the lines a bit.
Yeah. Some people really make it work. And I think that's great. Like, for me, I think I just need a little bit of space around my work. Like, I don't like sharing that with my romantic partner. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a much better like partner romantically when I'm not in that zone. So, but because of the pandemic, obviously we were kind of each other's only option. So we did end up doing a lot of kind of live streams together, like random stuff like that. And I think we've definitely gotten better at it. And, I still don't necessarily think we need to make it a full-time thing, but, you know, he also like has his own music that he wants to play, and
right.
It's not sad folk songs. Like, he wants to play fiddle tunes and I want to play songs, and like I obsess over songs and he obsesses over tunes. And like, if the show becomes a compromise, you know, it's like, yeah. So it's an awesome relationship. It's really nice to be able to call each other and complain about, you know, sure. Like, oh my God, like so-and-so's being so annoying. Like, you need that person that's not there.
Right.
It's nice that it's not him that's annoying.
Right. Yeah, right. But it's also nice to have somebody that has the ears for what you're doing to kind of be like, hey,
absolutely.
Like you said, he listens to the mix and goes, stop.
This exactly. You know,
this is great.
I do think like the fact that we both are touring musicians, I mean, that really is amazing, because I have that support and understanding, and I'm able to give him that support and understanding. And it's not, you know, one of us kind of being left at home while the other goes off on adventures. It's very much like, okay, I understand that you need to change this plan because I'm going to need to change this plan in 2 weeks.
Right.
And there's a lot of flexibility.
Speak the same language than that.
Yeah. It's super nice. And we do get the chance to do a lot of like rogue vacationing, because it's like, oh, do you have this weekend off? I'm going to be in California. Like, come meet me and we'll spend 3 days, or those things you don't have the flexibility to do with your kind of standard job hours.
Sure.
So there's a lot of really great things about it, even though we're not always touring together.
I love that. Well, thank you so much, Rachel, for doing this and chatting with me today. I can't wait to
it's been
hear the whole record. I love the most recent song, or the Jokes on Me and No Good Time for Dying. They're amazing. I love the artwork for that you put out, the t-shirts for Jokes on Me with.
Oh, thank you. My friend Anna Jane Lester designed those. She's awesome.
Those are amazing. I love the like the simplicity of the art and the drawing of the,
I love the
broken leg. It looks amazing. So
thank you.
And good luck on the shows coming up. That's exciting. Hopefully you'll play Nashville soon.
Yeah, Nashville on June 12th at the City Winery. I'll be playing.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the family and I will have to come out and,
Definitely. Check it out.
That's,
let me know if you want to come out.
That's really cool. Yeah. That would be amazing. And I do have one more question for you. I want to know if you have any advice for aspiring artists.
Well, let's see. I guess it kind of, to me, and I feel like I stress some people out by saying this, because I said this to a student one time and I feel like she almost started crying, but and so I don't mean this as a stressful thing, but it kind of goes back to that first thing I was saying. Like, I'm a big advocate for not having a plan B, because I think it's really hard once you have a routine and security to kind of quit that. Whereas if you never have it, it doesn't feel so crazy. So I'm very much like a learn by doing type of person. So when people say like, how do you become a full-time musician? I'm like, well, just don't get another job. I mean, of course you have to do things for money, but like, don't make it anything that you're going to have a hard time quitting. Nothing that's actually like a good job that you want, just something that is for money. And people do that in different ways, but you know, so that's why I was like, my student was like, I just got this amazing job. And I was like, I'm so sorry. No, do it. Whatever works for you. But that's what worked for me. You know, what worked for me is just like diving right in. And I guess it depends on your personality. But if you have the inkling to just dive in and not get a plan B going on, I would just go for it.